Hi, everyone. You're listening to Tech and Savvy. I'm Emily.
And I'm April.
And today we're going to be talking about sustainability, the environment, and biological modeling. And we have with us here Annie Innisgold. Hi, Annie.
Hey, Emily. Hi, April. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on. And you're coming to us from Hawaii, is that right?
Yes, I am calling in from Honolulu, where I'm a PhD student at the University of Hawaii Manoa.
I've known Annie for a very long time, since we were in fourth grade, I think.
Yeah, I think around there, maybe even earlier, but definitely elementary school.
Yeah, and I feel like you've had so many different career ideas since then. You were very into art, music, fencing, so many different possibilities before you got into bio. And actually, that's what our theme song is, Annie's Van, 414. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Very on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome. Now you guys get to use some music from my college band. And now I'm excited to actually be on here to talk about what I do for my career now.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you. I'm always joking with Emily that you're like our number one fan.
I really am. I always listen to the episodes. Can't say I comprehend everything you guys talk about, but I do my best.
Yeah, and so we're really glad to have you here with us. So can we start a little bit with you telling us about your academic career, how you made your way to getting a PhD?
Yeah, for sure. So it wasn't really something I always thought I was going to do. So I went to college at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. So did Emily. So we spent lots of time together there. And that was kind of when I started to get like seriously interested in biology and ecology and environmental research. So when I started off college, I wasn't, entirely sure what I was going to study, but I got involved in some ecology research because kind of nature and the environment was always something I was really interested in. And so when thinking about kind of focusing on what I wanted to study, that was something that kind of stood out to me. So I ended up getting involved in tree frog research and spending some time in Panama for a summer and continuing that research back at Vassar. And I just really found that I kind of liked doing scientific research and the problem solving aspects and creative thinking that went into it and combining, my love for being outside and nature and everything like that. So that was my first research experiment, or my first research experience was with these tree frogs. And then kind of marine biology was something that had always been in the back of my mind since I was a kid. And I did a summer internship that really kind of solidified that for me. And that was at Bigelow Lab in Maine. And so there I was doing kind of video and data analysis of coral reef fish, a study about kind of their herbivory. So they'll eat the algae on coral reefs. And so when I did that internship, it pretty much solidified that I wanted to continue in scientific research and focus on marine biology. And so it was through that I got connected with a professor who I ended up doing my master's with at the University of Rhode Island. And so I continued on kind of this marine ecosystem research, but focused a little bit more on fisheries and fishery sustainability at the University of Rhode Island. And through there, I decided that I wanted to pursue a research career. And so the next step for me was to start a PhD program. And so that was kind of what took me here. And I had always been interested in coral reefs. That was something since I did that internship in college that I could kind of see myself studying for a PhD. And so I was looking for opportunities in the coral reef field. And I'm just really grateful that it worked out to be at the University of Hawaii. So I just started here in January, so I'm pretty new and just getting things going, but it's been really exciting so far to continue to be involved in this kind of research.
It's so cool to see how many different research opportunities too in biology and ecology and in all these different places that you've had too. And you're still just starting your PhD and you obviously have a master's, but you've had a lot of opportunities for research, which is really awesome. So now we're going to get into the next portion of our talk, which is ecosystem modeling and conservation tech. So, you know, we are tech and savvy. If we can, we're always going to try to weave in some tech, but coding and modeling is actually really important in a lot of sciences. So I'm glad we're getting to talk about that. So Annie, can you describe what modeling is in science?
Yeah, and this is a topic I'm really excited to talk about too, because it's something I've gotten a good bit of experience with in the last couple of years. So generally, when you think about scientific modeling, you're just thinking about some kind of representation of what you're studying. And so that can come in a kind of more like conceptual or qualitative form. So if it was like that, it might just show like the direction of change of your study system. Like, does it increase or decrease? Or the other side of modeling is the more mathematical or quantitative modeling, which is more used to make, you know, concrete predictions of change over time. And so you can really model all sorts of things when thinking about biological modeling. I tend to think of the more like environmental examples. So I think of, you can model, you know, the changing climate and rising temperatures. You can model nutrient pollution and runoff, and you can try to predict how these environmental stressors will change over time. And this whole field of biological modeling is really growing, and there's a lot of opportunities in it. So it's something to get involved in if you know that's what you're interested in. It's a good time for that.
And what do you use to model? Are you using R?
Yeah. Python, yeah, I would say
those two. Yeah.
So for in kind of the more ecology side of things, R is the biggest program right now to use. But some researchers use Python as well. And from what I hear, Python is kind of the up and coming one, which I'm like, I like R. I'm settled with it. But that's definitely a good one to know. And then some models, depending on, you know, what you're using, will actually have their own platform. So you can end up doing all your coding and your model runs just in a platform that's specific to the actual model that you're using.
Okay, so that's good for people to learn if they're interested.
Yeah, if there's like one model that you think will work really well for your question, you can kind of check and see what the best platform is.
Nice. And for your master's, you did a research master's that involved a lot of ecosystem modeling. Can you talk about that more?
Yeah. So when you think about ecosystem models, you're really trying to represent a whole lot of different things in one model. So I was building an ecosystem model for Narragansett Bay, Rhode Island, which is an estuary, you know, right off the coast of Rhode Island. And what my model ended up looking like is basically this mathematical food web model. So I'm trying to represent who eats who in this marine food web. And I also included fisheries as part of the food web, you know, kind of at the top, because they're still, you know, they're taking fish out of the food web that are then not available to other predators. So they really are part of the food web as well. And so by creating this model, I was able to simulate different scenarios and run them for, you know, several years into the future and say, what if there were suddenly no more fishing in Rhode Island? Or what if there was double the fishing? And I could kind of test the limits of the ecosystem and say, you know, how much fishing can this food web sustain? And there still be enough fish to, you know, sustain themselves over time and sustain the other groups of organisms in the food web. and really, this ecosystem modeling is such a useful tool because these aren't things that you could go out and do experimentally, right? I can't say, okay, I'm going to double the fishing pressure this year. In real life, but in a model, you can really run whatever scenarios you want. And so they're being used really heavily in environmental management, like fisheries management and stuff, because there's so much emphasis on trying to understand and predict what the ecosystem will be able to sustain.
That's awesome. And So what did you find about doubling the fishing or taking it all away? Was it very drastic?
So it was, honestly, there isn't too much fishing in that area of Rhode Island. So what I found was overall, like, it's pretty well, it's able to sustain itself pretty well at the current levels that it's at. When you kind of test these more extreme scenarios, it really depends. Some groups are able to kind of recover, or they're not affected as much, whereas some groups will crash a bit more and the populations will really decrease. So it's pretty variable depending on what kind of group of species you're interested in. But something that was kind of a main component of my research was really trying to emphasize the social system. So like the human dimension of ecosystem modeling, which is something that's often, you know, kind of left out or maybe a kind of secondary to the ecological side of the research. So I was trying to make sure that was incorporated into my model adequately. So really when I use the term like social ecological modeling is kind of what I use to describe the model that I made. And so that's really just trying to emphasize that humans are part of the system as well. They're not like a separate entity. It's really all part of one ecosystem. And so for my model, I actually created a separate model representing kind of fisher behavior and trying to test how does human behavior impact the ecosystem, but also how does human behavior change in response to the ecosystem? So not just thinking about human impacts on the ecosystem, but also thinking about how human behavior will change as the ecosystem changes. And so really what I found there was that incorporating behavior can totally change the outcomes of your model runs. And so it needs to be something that is more often incorporated into these types of ecosystem models.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wouldn't have that immediate thought that, oh, you know, we think about humans' impact on the environment, but then yes, you have to think about if you change, the environment changes, it impacts human, it's kind of the cycle. So yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Because really, it's really hard to predict how humans behave too. That's something I think researchers struggle with because humans don't always behave in the sense that, you know, researchers and environmental managers think that they will. And so it's hard to just use like a static number to represent that. You want to try to create a more dynamic representation of how behavior actually changes over time.
Yeah, so it sounds like ecosystem modeling is a really powerful tool within marine biology and within in the environmental conservation space. Are there any other technologies used in that space besides ecosystem modeling that make a similar impact?
Yeah, so really there's so many different kind of applications of technology in environmental research and management. So I'm sure, you know, there are so many that I could mention, but there's kind of a couple others I've been reading about and learning about recently. So one of them comes down to like remote sensing technologies. So when you think about like drones and kind of satellite imagery and things like that, that is something that is fairly new to, at least when I'm thinking about like fisheries and marine ecosystem management. But it's a really cool tool because you can actually learn a lot about those ecosystems from these satellite images. You can kind of quantify the different habitat types and the amount of algae and things like that. And you're able to kind of infer the health of the fish populations and the reef in general. So that's a pretty exciting area for these new and developing technologies that my current lab at UH Manoa is working on. So it's something I'm starting to learn about and I'm really excited to get a bit more involved in. Another area I wanted to mention is something I was reading about the other day as I'm thinking about how to design some kind of artificial structures for my PhD research here that I would install in the coastal waters here off Hawaii. You can create kind of artificial reef structures, which have been used to promote fish population growth and things like that. And they've been, I think they're very frequently created using things like cinder blocks and materials like that. But there have been some recent applications where they'll actually try to 3D print reefs and things like that to install them. So that's another thing I've just been learning about recently, but is a pretty exciting application of technology in marine science and something that's pretty original, not necessarily something I would have thought of immediately when it comes to marine science.
Yeah, that does sound really, really cool, especially since we know that a lot of coral reefs have been devastated by climate change. The idea that you're able to 3D print a coral reef, and you're saying it's being used to kind of like bring the, you know, bring the fish population and other animals back into the reef area to kind of stimulate growth there again?
Yeah. So the idea behind it is that fish really like kind of complex habitat structures like that. And so in areas where the coral has died out or there's not a lot of coral, there's not usually going to be really, you know, healthy fish populations because they need some kind of habitat structure where they can, you know, hide from predators and things like that. And so there are some really good examples of successful artificial reefs where they'll, you know, kind of promote these pretty healthy fish populations because of the kind of complex habitat structure that's going on there.
Nice. And I think that is a really good example of just how climate change is forcing environmental tech to advance at a quicker pace and become more innovative. Do you have any more examples, or do you want to comment on how quickly environmental tech is advancing because of climate change?
Yeah, it does really feel like technology is moving quickly, which is totally necessary because climate change is also moving really quickly. And so, I mean, I've been seeing lots of examples of kind of exciting technology that can be used to combat climate change. So, I mean, there are some that we're all maybe more familiar with, like solar panels and wind turbines and electric cars, these technologies that are trying to move us away from fossil fuel dependence and towards, you know, more use of renewable energy sources. In terms of other technologies that are trying to promote kind of more environmentally friendly habits, there are kind of plant-based meat products that are being grown in labs. So that's a pretty new and exciting technology that are trying to reduce the demand on large-scale agriculture that contributes a lot to climate change. So by creating, you know, lab-grown meat products, they're able to take a little bit of that pressure off the resources that large-scale agriculture is using. And then one example, bringing it back to marine biology, is that feels really futuristic to me, is actually like gene editing in corals, where you can, scientists will, you know, manipulate the genomes of corals and try to increase their thermal tolerance. So increase their ability to survive in warmer waters, because increasing water temperatures is a huge stressor for corals. It causes coral bleaching and then it causes them to die. And so researchers are trying to edit genes in corals to potentially help them be able to survive in warmer waters. So overall, it's pretty exciting to see all these different forms of technology and how they're being used to combat climate change. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean we can keep going at the rate that we're going in for climate change, because it'll take more, I think, than some of, you know, technology advancement to really stop all the detrimental impacts that we are seeing.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense, because it's kind of like you're in a race. You're trying to keep up with, you know, everything that's happening with climate change and how humans are affecting climate change. And there's only so far you can go before, you know, you kind of hit a ceiling. But it is really interesting, like you said, to see how researchers are coming up with new ways to, you know, in a way, I don't want to say save the environment, but kind of work on fixing the issues that we already have.
Yeah, that the race analogy is really good, because we not only want to like catch up with it, but we want to slow the other side down. And so the technologies can kind of help us come up with these solutions, but we still need, you know, those policies and changing how our society functions to slow, you know, slow the climate change side down.
Yeah, thanks for all those examples, Annie. I do think that's, it's so interesting how tech is being used in these ways to also help the environment, combining like two of my interests and I think two of all of our interests. So that's really cool. We're now going to talk more about sustainability. So can you first explain what sustainability is?
Yeah, sustainability is a really complex concept. I mean, it's like sounds simple in theory, but there's so many different parts to it. It's really like multifaceted. So by no means am I an expert in all of sustainability. I feel like I study a really small piece of it, and it's something I'm really passionate about, but there's so much to learn there. So I'm, you know, still feel like I'm learning new aspects of sustainability all the time. But when it comes down to defining what sustainability is, it's really the idea that you are using resources in a way that ensures that there will still be enough left for generations to come. So just the idea of generational sustainability. You want to be able to, you know, keep these resources available over the long term. And so this relates to the idea that resources are finite, right? There's not an infinite amount of them. There's only so much. And so if we want to leave enough for, you know, our kids and grandkids, for other generations, we can't take all the resources. We have to make sure that we leave enough that it will, the, you know, whatever resource we're using will be able to sustain itself over the long term.
So now that we know what sustainability is, what are some things that people can do every day to just be more environmentally friendly and live in a way that's more sustainable?
Yeah, there are a lot of kind of small individual actions that people can take that, you know, may not feel like a huge difference to you, but if there are things that are done, you know, on a widespread level, they can really add up. And so a big one comes down to just where you put your money, because as we know, like big corporations and things are producing so much of greenhouse gases that are contributed to climate change and stuff. So thinking about the businesses you support, and whether, you know, are they the big companies that are huge polluters? Are they producing tons of single-use plastics? Or, you know, are they companies that are kind of committed to the idea of sustainability and they're investing in clean energy and, you know, compostable material and renewable things like that? So that's a big one, is just trying to be aware of what, you know, what businesses and companies you're supporting and what their habits are. Kind of along with where you put your money is, this one might seem obvious, but just buying less, right? We live in a society where, you know, people really will just buy things that they don't necessarily need. And so just really trying to be conscious of what you need and what you don't need is a huge thing to do. That see, it sounds simple, but that is, I feel like, one of the biggest things to do is just trying to be conscious of that. And, you know, for products you do buy, try to avoid single-use plastics, since of all the materials out there, plastic is the one that, you know, essentially doesn't degrade ever. And so it'll just turn into these tiny microplastics that are found, you know, they're found throughout the ocean, they're found in our food, they're really found everywhere. So that if, you know, if you're able to avoid single-use plastics, that's a good decision to make, you know, when you have that option. Along with that, buying secondhand when you have the option, I think, is one of the most environmentally friendly things you can do. So I've been hearing a lot about the terms, you know, fast fashion and even like fast furniture, basically the idea of these products that are not made to last. They tend to be cheaper and a bit more convenient. So that's a big kind of, I feel like, the biggest obstacle there, because it's often easier to buy those products. But by buying these products that won't last over the long term, it's just producing so much waste. And so if you're able to buy products secondhand, that is a really great option. And again, like, it's not about, you know, being perfect and being able to do this for everything that you do, but just kind of making the effort when you're able to. So when I think back to a few months ago, when I moved to Hawaii, I didn't have any furniture, didn't have any stuff like that. So I tried to buy as much as I could, you know, off of Facebook Marketplace, off of Craigslist and things like that. Obviously, I couldn't find every single thing I needed off there, but I was still able to make, you know, get quite a lot of what I needed from those places and for a really good price because it was all secondhand. So it's just, you know, I think about making that effort where you're able to.
Okay, so if I could summarize, you're saying buy smart, meaning, you know, think about where you're buying from, have that awareness. Buy less, buy secondhand, avoid plastic. Those are some of the ways. And I just had a question. When you say, you know, think about the companies that you're buying from and if they're environmentally friendly, are there any like sources that you use to find that out? Or is that really just, you know, researching some of the big companies that you might use over and over again?
Yeah. So there's not necessarily one source that I go to for that information. But, you know, there are kind of compiled lists available of like, you know, the companies that are the biggest polluters, the biggest plastic polluters and things like that. And then, yeah, just kind of doing your research if there's companies that you feel like you're consistently buying from and things like that, trying to dig a little bit more into their habits and, you know, what they are supporting. So it kind of depends, I think, on, you know, the product and the company, but just trying to do your research, especially if it's something that you feel like you're consistently buying from.
Yeah, that's really helpful because like you said, and it's really about just making the effort if you can, but not, you know, you don't have to be perfect. Nobody's being like perfect about it necessarily, but it's just about being aware.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I also wanted to talk about some of the challenges or barriers that you see for people trying to live more sustainably. And I know there's so many, but I thought we could get into that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So there are so many barriers because just the way that our society works does not necessarily promote, you know, it doesn't make it easy for us to engage in all these sustainable habits. So I think, you know, potentially the biggest one just comes down to money again, right? Like sustainable products, especially if you're trying to buy from, you know, more local or small scale businesses, they're often more expensive. And so if you're not in a financially stable position, it can be really hard to justify buying products that are more expensive when these bigger businesses are putting out similar products for cheaper. I feel like that is just such a huge barrier for so many people. And then, you know, similarly to that, the idea of access, depending on where you live, you just might not have access to products that are sustainably sourced. So if you don't have access, you know, how are you supposed to engage in those environmentally friendly habits? So again, like thinking about single-use plastics, they're everywhere, you know, it's hard to avoid them. Same with fossil fuels that are such a big contributor to climate change, and we rely on them for everything. And so it's just so hard to avoid these things when they're so prevalent throughout our society. And then the whole, you know, COVID situation has really been tough for the single-use plastics because so many businesses have switched back to that and switched, you know, to more takeout things because they've had to. And so, well, you know, travel has been reduced and things like that, which has been better in terms of, you know, greenhouse gas production. Single-use plastic has gotten way worse since the pandemic began.
Nice. And something else I wanted to bring up is, I think is a huge barrier, is environmental racism, which for anyone who's listening or watching, environmental racism has to do with how communities of people of color or people of low socioeconomic backgrounds are often more burdened with hazardous, you know, pollution and waste that goes along with climate change and how humans are affecting the environment. So Annie, I just wanted to know if you also wanted to kind of address how environmental racism impacts sustainability efforts.
Yeah, it's definitely such a huge barrier as well to working towards a more sustainable society. And I think part of that is just because the issues of climate change and of systemic racism are often treated as such separate issues when they really are so closely intertwined, right? We can't, you know, fix climate change without addressing systemic racism. It's just not, it's not possible. And so, I mean, the first step is like us, you know, all recognizing and all our elected officials recognizing and addressing that not everyone is equally affected by climate change. So we see that poor communities and disproportionately Black and Latinx communities are really seeing, you know, the worst of it, are really bearing the burden of climate change, both in terms of temperature, their communities are in getting, you know, are hotter, like the temperature there is rising faster than in other locations. They're dealing with more pollution. And so climate change is taking these racial disparities and just exacerbating them. So first step is recognizing that that is happening. Then, you know, we need national funding. We need resources to go towards solutions in those communities that are being affected like this, because they don't necessarily have the option to just pick up and leave when their area is, you know, hit by a natural disaster or when pollution gets really bad. Like wealthier communities can just, you know, leave, and that's not an option for everyone. So I think really it's really so important to not only include voices from these communities, you know, in sustainability conversations, but really just be listening. And those are the voices in the communities that should be leading these efforts, because those are the people that are being affected. And one thing that I think that we all have a lot to learn from, especially when I think about fisheries management and really just natural resource use in general, is Indigenous communities who have been living sustainably for so long. And so I think looking back to, you know, their practices and how they use resources can take us really far in terms of living more sustainably. And I think, you know, that's a direction that, you know, some people are starting to go in. And I think that's a really important direction we need to be thinking about.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with what you're saying about amplifying the voices of the people who actually live in those communities that are being affected. You know, for example, when the Keystone Pipeline, when there were all those protests going around about that, and a lot of people, you know, especially politicians, were ignoring the Indigenous community, who were telling them that this is going to adversely affect the environment, it's going to adversely affect their communities, and they were, you know, basically shut down. And it's the same way with, you know, people who live in communities like Flint, where they still have lead in their water and it's not clean. And even recently with what was going on in Texas, you know, people who lived in poorer communities, which tend to be more populated by Black and Latinx people, they were the ones who were the last to get power back. And so I think that makes a lot of sense, like you said, that we really have to focus on the communities that are affected the most first if we really want to tackle climate change.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one, you know, kind of exciting thing that happened this year was Deb Haaland being appointed the U.S. Secretary of the Interior, you know, the first Native American to be in that position. And so I know that felt like a, you know, a big step forward in this, you know. So, you know, a glimmer of hope.
Yeah, definitely. And another topic I wanted to bring up, which I think is kind of related to environmental racism a little bit, is how food sustainability has also become a really big issue. And I wanted to know if you could expand a little bit on that and give us a few examples of how, you know, we can improve our food sustainability and reduce food waste.
Yeah, this is a topic I am so interested in. I feel like it takes up a lot of my brain space because it's something I'm passionate about, and I do fisheries research, so it's, you know, related to my work. So thinking first about kind of land-based food products. So we know that large-scale agriculture is a huge contributor to greenhouse gas production. And so thinking about, you know, the individual food choices you make, they can really add up if a lot of people are doing them. Kind of general rules, plant-based products are more sustainable to their animal-based counterparts, especially when it comes to like red meat and dairy. So that's really because plant-based products usually will use less fossil fuels and water and land for their production compared to animal products. And so if you're able to buy more plant-based products, that's a great thing to do. And if you do choose to buy animal products, if you're able to, it's great to buy from more like small scale or local producers in terms of being more environmentally friendly with your food choices. But obviously, it takes a lot of privilege to be in a situation where you can make these dietary choices, where you can, you know, give up animal products and still have a healthy diet or still get enough protein and things like that. And so if you're part of, you know, the population in wealthy countries where you can do this, you know, buying plant-based products is a great thing to do. But if you're in an area where you don't necessarily have access to healthy food options, that, you know, relates to the idea of like a food desert, you're not always going to have the option to make those choices. Thinking a bit more about fisheries, so like ocean-based products, which is an area, this is the area that I study, so it's something I'm really excited to talk about. But generally buying, again, small-scale or local fishers is a great option rather than kind of more large-scale or mass-produced things. But if you don't live in a coastal area, that's not always going to be something that's easy to do. So just trying to educate yourself about what species are sustainable. So what, you know, what is there plenty of versus what fish are maybe overfished. So there's not enough really left to kind of maintain itself over the long term. So an app that I have is called Seafood Watch. So you can enter the species that of seafood that you want to eat, and it will kind of give you information on whether this is a responsible choice or not. So that's a kind of cool resource. I would say the only problem is that when you buy seafood, there isn't always tons of information on the packaging that you can't always know, you know, what gear it was caught with, where it was caught, and things like that, that you really do need to know if it's truly a good choice for the environment or not. And that just ties back to the idea that it's really hard to track seafood from when it's caught till when it gets all the way, you know, to the store, to the restaurant. And so that makes it really hard for people to make informed choices about their seafood consumption. Another kind of resource is that some seafood will be what's called like certified sustainable seafood. And so there are different organizations that will certify seafood as sustainable, which means that they have met certain qualifications where they're not having detrimental impacts on the fish population or on the rest of the ecosystem. And the idea behind this is that then the customer can choose products that are certified sustainable. And so the customer is then kind of incentivizing these fisheries to continue to act sustainably because they're supporting them. But again, this is not always so, you know, not always super clear cut, because there's actually a lot of debate around this topic where companies will certify fisheries as sustainable. And then some people, you know, will say, actually, that fishery, you know, should not be certified. It's not acting in an environmentally friendly way. And that gets to the term of like greenwashing, which is when a company will make you think that it's environmentally friendly when it's actually, you know, maybe not. And so I think in theory, certified sustainable seafood is, you know, a great way to, it's a great idea. But it's, I think, still a work in progress because, yeah, it's not, it's still not always easy to tell if something is, you know, truly sustainably sourced, if it just based off of if it has that certification sticker on it or not. But it's something to, you know, be aware of and think about and, you know, do your research on. So when it comes down to making environmentally friendly decisions for your seafood consumption, generally aquaculture, which is another term for fish farming or for seafood farming, can often be a more sustainable alternative to wild catch. And aquaculture is on the rise around the world. It's increasing. So that's a good thing because it will take some of the pressure off of wild fish stocks. And another kind of tip generally when it comes to seafood is eating lower on the food chain is better. So things kind of like seaweed and shellfish, like oysters and mussels that are at the bottom of the food chain, tend to be more sustainable than consuming like big fish and things like that that tend to be higher up. So I think it's hard to make informed decisions about food sustainability just because of sometimes the lack of information that is out there. But I would say overall, the easiest tip and the best tip is just don't waste your food no matter what you eat, because food waste is a huge problem. And that is by far the easiest thing that we can all do to contribute to food sustainability.
Yeah, thank you. Those were a lot of great tips. So to kind of summarize what you're saying, we know that a huge contributor to greenhouse gas production is large-scale agriculture, you know, such as cattle farming. So one of the easiest steps someone can take to be more sustainable when it comes to food is to adopt, you know, a more plant-based diet, eat less meat. But we do know that not everybody it has access to those healthy foods to convert towards a convert to a plant-based diet because of food deserts. But if you are privileged enough to have that option and you have the money to do it, then that's a really good way to help with food sustainability. And when it comes to fisheries, we know that overfishing is a problem because people love seafood. So there, like you said, there's an app called Seafood Watch where you can enter the species of fish you're interested in and you can learn more about it and figure out if that fish is a responsible and sustainable choice for you to eat. And another resource you talked about is that there is certified seafood where organizations can be certified fisheries, and they can be certified as sustainable if they meet certain qualifications, which is a great idea and concept. But like you said, it's kind of murky right now. There are some organizations that are pretending to be certified or acting like they're environmentally friendly, but they're not. And something that's really exciting that's coming up is aquaculture, which is fish farming, and it's making it easy. It's taking the load off of having to, you know, catch fish in the wild, and it is becoming a more sustainable option than the mass fishing that we see on a daily basis. And if all else fails and you can't do any of that, just eat whatever you have on your plate. Don't waste your food is the biggest thing.
Yes, thank you for summarizing my long rant about fish and things.
It was a good rant. And, you know, I don't know if you've heard or not, but climate change has become an important political issue. So can you give us a few tips and ways that people can use their votes to voice their opinion on climate change?
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, I think we've all been seeing this issue come up more and more in debates and things like that. And I don't know about for you guys, but when like watching the presidential debates last fall, it was so frustrating to me to see them, like the question would be like, oh, do you believe in climate change and things like that? And not like, how are you going to address climate change? I'm like, ah, oh, like other countries are so, you know, so much farther ahead and not debating whether this is happening. So that I was like, so hard to watch. but yeah, when it comes down to like sustainable habits, I mean, voting is one of the biggest things that anyone can do to make a difference, because so much, you know, of the greenhouse gas production and things like that that are contributing to climate change are from big businesses and from corporations and the military and things that it's hard to feel like we can control them individually. And so that's why voting is such, you know, a big thing you can do, because you can vote for people who have the power to make, you know, change the way that change kind of the policies and the management of things like this so that these huge contributors, you know, may actually have to change the way that they run and actually have a big impact on greenhouse gas production. So really just thinking about how you use your vote is a huge thing that you can do. And so to kind of move towards a more sustainable society, we need to vote for people who will prioritize this issue and prioritize the issue of, you know, environmental sustainability and also the sustainability of the people who, you know, depend on the environment. And so, like we mentioned earlier, climate change is bringing out these racial disparities. And so we need to vote for people who will treat this issue like a crisis and not like something that can wait around, because it really can't. And then, you know, once we have elected these officials, which seems like we have at least, you know, a step in the right direction, we need to continually pressure them to follow through with what they promised and not kind of, you know, forget about all the things they said during the campaign. And so that feels like where we're at now. But really just voting and advocating for clean energy and things like that is one of the most important individual actions that everyone can take.
Yeah, I think those are some great tips. And like you said, just do your research on who you're voting for and vote for people who prioritize climate change, people who actually believe in climate change, and have actually put in the effort to make it a priority and something that needs to be addressed. All right. And so now we're going to move on to the section where we talk about how to get into biology and, you know, environmental conservation if someone's interested in the field. So Annie, can you give us some details on the kind of background someone needs to get into this field?
Yeah, definitely. And so I feel like there's not necessarily like one right background that someone would need to get involved in biology or in conservation. So I majored in biology in college, but I also studied anthropology. And a big reason of why I got into my master's program and why I got that research position was because I'd studied anthropology and because I had kind of a background in the natural and social sciences. And that was something that was kind of, I think, set me apart a little bit and was good for my project because I was thinking kind of more in that social ecological realm. And so having a background in some social science as well, I feel like really helped me out, which was not really what I was thinking about in college when I decided to do that, but I think was definitely something that I'm really grateful that I did. So I think there's, yeah, you can have a background in a variety of skills that would still help you out in this field. And another one is kind of the more data science and coding aspect, I think has helped me out so much. I was really lucky in college to have a professor who was willing to work with me on learning R and learning, you know, statistics and how to analyze data. And that I just has helped me out so many times, really repeatedly, because even like now when I see, you know, postings for jobs and for grad school and stuff, more and more, they want people who can code and who can analyze data, because that's just such a useful skill no matter what project you're going to be on. So I think learning to code is definitely a plus, but really just having experience out in other fields is, I would say, a good thing because you can kind of bring a different perspective into the field, which can be so important in more interdisciplinary research, which I think is the direction that a lot of research is heading in, is this kind of more interdisciplinary realm, because when thinking about environmental problems, they're often a combination of kind of more biological, environmental components, as well as, you know, political and social things. And so having a background in either of those areas, you can really bring a lot to the table.
Yeah, it's really great. It's nice to hear about the, you know, the variety of backgrounds that someone can have that can be of service in this field. And what are some jobs or what are some common jobs that you see in this field?
Yeah, so there's kind of a few different sectors, I would say, that people generally work in terms of conservation. And so There's these more like management focused agencies, which are often like government jobs. And so you could work for like NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or DEM, you know, the Department of Environmental Management. Those are kind of some organizations that are often hiring kind of more research or environmentally focused jobs. Then there's, I would say, the nonprofit sector. There's many different environmental nonprofits that will hire people both for research and for education and for a variety of things like that. And so there'll be a lot of people that will end up working in the nonprofit areas. And then, of course, there's academia, which is what I'm a bit more familiar with at the moment because I've just continued to be a student for forever. And so in academia, you know, there are research positions, there's grad school, both master's and PhD positions, and then there's also like field techs or lab techs, which are generally jobs that you can get, you know, after your undergrad or after your master's if you want to work, if you want to continue to like work in a lab, but, you know, not be in school. And generally when looking for jobs, I'm going to speak more to academia since that's what I'm more familiar with. I would say for science research, Twitter is actually where they're often posted. I've never had a LinkedIn, but I'll have my like science Twitter, and it's just, that's where like the really community is. And so I'll see job postings or openings for, you know, grad student positions. I see them posted on Twitter all the time. And so if you're looking for, I would say, an academic job or to start grad school, getting on Twitter is one of the best things that you can do to look for those opportunities. When I'm thinking about grad school, so I think what people often don't realize about research-based science grad school is generally you will get paid for it. So you don't have to pay tuition. You don't have to, like you will get a stipend and they'll pay for your tuition. Assuming, you know, once you're accepted and once you kind of work with your once you contact your advisor and things like that. But I'm going to give a bit of a caveat that grad school often does not pay enough. And so this is, I think, why so many grad schools have low diversity and have such a problem with this, is because they're not necessarily paying enough for people who have other financial responsibilities to attend, right? Because essentially when you're in grad school, you're doing research and you're potentially taking classes. It's a full-time gig, but you're not getting paid for a full-time job. And so this excludes a lot of people who have financial obligations which they would need to work a full-time job for. So small caveat, but I mean, obviously it's great that you can get paid compared to other fields where you still have to pay for grad school. But it's still, you know, it's not gonna work for everybody who have other obligations. So that's one caveat. I would say the other is that it's pretty competitive in terms of, I mean, marine biology and environmental research. I see lots of opportunities, but there are also so many qualified people for it. And so it's not always easy to find jobs or to find, you know, grad school positions because there are so many people who are interested in it and there's not, you know, not enough jobs. So I think potentially now that we have an administration that's more, you know, focused on the environment and on climate change, there'll be more funding going towards this field. And so hopefully we will see more job openings and things like that. But yeah, that, I think that is something that, you know, can be a challenge to people who want to get involved.
Yeah, I think, like you said, that makes a lot of sense. And it seems like there really is a wide variety of work that you can do within conservation. I did find it really interesting when you said that essentially if you're really looking to network or, you know, find funding or, you know, grad school opportunities, Twitter is the place to go, not LinkedIn. I feel like a lot of people tend to think that LinkedIn, if you're looking for a job, is the way to go. But apparently when it comes to science and research, Twitter is the way to go.
It really is. It's the place to be.
We need to get on that. need to get on Twitter.
And if I don't want to work in the sector, but I'm interested in it, what are some ways that I can volunteer when it comes to conservation?
Yeah, so I mean, for people who have jobs and are, you know, not wanting to pursue careers in biology and conservation, there are lots of volunteer opportunities. And they can depend a bit on where you live. But you can look for, you know, things like coastal beach cleanups, or, you know, different kinds of cleanup initiatives will happen all over in, you know, parks or rivers or the beach. So that's kind of a great way to help out in your local community and things like that. In terms of getting involved in like some research projects, the term citizen science kind of applies, you know, means that anyone can really help out on it. It doesn't have to be what you do for your career, but you can kind of help in this research project. And so you can check online. I think you can go to, for US-based projects, there's citizenscience.gov, and they will post different projects, and they'll say if they're looking for volunteers at the time. And so if you're looking for a way to kind of to be involved in research and contribute to some scientific efforts, but you don't necessarily want it to be your career, I think that's a great thing you can do to check out. Especially you can kind of browse through the projects and see if there are any that look particularly interesting to you. So there are definitely a range of volunteer opportunities depending on your interest and depending on where you live, to help out with these kinds of things.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Annie, for all of that information. And oh, we talked about so much today.
We really did.
This was really great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys so much for having me on here. I'm always happy to come talk about, you know, sustainability and fish and everything like that.
So is there anywhere people can find you if they want to contact you or learn more?
Yeah, I think the best Twitter. I think the best way to find me would be on Twitter. My handle is at @A_InesGold. So spelled InesGold. It's my last name. Or you can search Annie Ines Gold on Twitter and you can find me there. And yeah, I'm happy to talk more about any of the, you know, anything we talked about today.
Awesome. And yeah, if anyone's interested in tech and savvy as well, you can go to our website, tech-savvy.com. That's where you can find all the links to our social media, such as our Instagram. You can find links to YouTube and to this podcast on a lot of different things like Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts. So yeah, I think that's all we have for today.
All right. Thanks everyone for joining. And now Annie will play us out.